Welcome to the podcast of the Diane Rehm Show Friday News Roundup. A panel of journalists joins Diane to discuss the week's top stories from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Dogpile.com. All of these search engines piled into one: Google, Yahoo, Live Search, and Ask.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. In 1916, preparedness parades marched in American cities to prime the nation for war. Newspaper headlines warned of German spies. But in writer Andrea Barrett's fictional world, isolated tuberculosis patients hardly sense the danger. The setting of her latest novel is a large public sanatorium in the Adirondack Mountains. The patients take comfort in gossip, rumor, and a weekly discussion group until a terrible accident forces the politics of war and anti-immigrant prejudice to invade their isolated world. Andrea Barrett joins me in the studio. Her novel is titled The Air We Breathe. If you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Andrea Barrett is the author of 8 books. She received the National Book Award for her novel titled Ship Fever. She was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Servants of the Map. She was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship in 2001 and was also a fellow at the Center for Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library. Andrea, it's so good to see you. Congratulations.
Thank you, and thank you for welcoming me here.
You have had quite a distinguished career, and I wonder about that MacArthur Fellowship. I think people are always curious about it, how it happened to come to you. Did you have any sense beforehand it might come to you, and how did it affect you?
I had no sense of it at all. One of the distinguishing features of the fellowship is they go to great pains not to let you know that you're being considered, and in my case, they were extremely successful. They had actually called me ostensibly to ask about some information about another writer, which I was thrilled to give. It's a writer I like very much. And then they asked me to be home on a specific day so they could talk to me further. And I went and did my homework and got everything prepared to talk about the other writer, and instead was told that a writer I knew perhaps even better than that writer, which is myself, had been awarded one. It was very, very funny, and I truly could not have been more surprised.
You really totally taken aback.
Completely. As far as I was concerned, it just came out of left field. I had no idea.
How did the prize itself affect your work, your ability to be free to work?
It's a almost incomprehensible gift for a writer, especially a literary writer. Most of us don't make enough from our writing to live solely by that. We teach and we do many other things to keep a roof over our head. So for me, it meant 5 years when I just didn't have to worry about that, when I could focus entirely on my writing, when I could think purely about what I wanted to write and not have to worry about whether it would be published, whether it would do all right if it was published. It's an astonishing gift for any artist.
How much was it?
it's $500,000 paid out over 5 years. So people often think that it comes in a single giant check, like a publisher's clearinghouse.
Yeah.
But in fact, it comes like a salary. It comes in quarterly installments. So it's like having an extremely well-paid job for which you don't have to do any work. It's $100,000 a year, and you pay taxes on it as you would with any income. So it just trickles in. I work and the checks come.
What is your lifestyle like? Describe it for us.
I live in northwestern Massachusetts in a converted mill building in an old industrial town in North Adams. So I'm surrounded by other artists. There's 40 lofts there. Painters, photographers, dancers, weavers, all sorts of wonderful, wonderful artists. It's very creative. It's sometimes chaotic, sometimes loud, always, always interesting.
How long have you been there?
I've been there 3 years now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And you live alone?
No, I'm married to a photographer. We have this big empty loft. He has his studio at one end, and I have my writing space at the other. And we have a dog and two cats that run between the two ends. Very fast sometimes, searching for food.
And do you have meals together?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. And we have walks with the dog together. It's quite rural where we live, and so I'm outside a lot, walking, swimming, snowshoeing. It's the Berkshires are very, very beautiful, and I love the mountains. I love being outside.
So the air we breathe as a title could well describe the air you breathe.
That's nice.
But it's a very, very different type of situation that your characters find themselves in. How did you first imagine this novel?
I had actually written about tuberculosis before. When I was a younger woman, we went very often to the northern Adirondacks to hike and climb and cross-country ski. And passing always through Lake Placid and Saranac Lake and Tupper Lake, I became aware that all the big houses in the area are wrapped in these giant porches. I started to wonder what the porches had been for. And when I learned that they had been covered by patients curing their tuberculosis, that just fascinated me. And I ended up writing a long story in an earlier book about people curing in private cure cottages in the late 1880s. Just as people were beginning to understand what caused tuberculosis but were still unable to treat it. As I was doing that, I became aware of these big public sanatoria tucked in the woods outside the villages and got very curious about what it would have been to be a patient from an urban area with no family around them, with no money, tucked in one of these buildings. There is something quite foreboding and rather prison-like about these buildings.
Who was it who made the decisions as to whether these individuals with tuberculosis would stay at home or be shuttled off?
It varied from city to city, but in all urban areas, there was a board of health, a board of doctors in the town who made a determination when they had a patient with tuberculosis about how serious it was and how that patient should best be cared for. If the patient was sick and contagious and didn't have any money, they would bring that case before a review board and decide if these are state institutions, so they're paid for by the taxpayers, decide if that individual should be sent to one of these sanatoria to cure, partly, of course, for the patient's benefit, but also partly for the community's benefit. People feared tuberculosis so much, and they were so worried about contracting it themselves. So there's both a good and a bad side to that decision to send someone away.
And, of course, simultaneously, there were private sanatoria, much perhaps on a different level from those that were public.
Much more luxurious, certainly, and much less crowded. People who had the means would go to a boarding house or a small private hospital in the hills where they would be very well taken care of. They might be in a group with 10 or 12 or 16 people in one of those situations. They could have all the visitors they wanted. Their families could motor up and see them. They had private doctors who came to care for them in the boarding cottage. In the public sanatoria, the rules were much more stringent. They didn't choose and didn't pay for their own medical care. There were resident doctors and doctors who came in to look after them. The situation was very different for them.
Were there actual cures?
Some people got better, but not directly as a result of the cure. There wasn't an antibiotic effective against tuberculosis until the late 1940s. So when people were sent away to cure, they were sent to a place where, among other things, they weren't working. If you came from a large urban area and you were working 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, and you were going home to an apartment that you might have shared with 10 or 12 people, and you weren't sleeping well, and you weren't getting enough to eat, it's easy to imagine how a person in that situation might get sick very quickly. If you're then sent to a place where you can rest, where you're being fed well, where you're not working, if your immune system is strong, you may get better simply from that. Your body's own defenses may be enough to help you overcome the disease. And that did happen to some people. It's hard to say that any of the treatments in those places actually affected the disease. I don't think they did.
But perhaps breathing that air is precisely what helped.
That's certainly what people thought. The air in places like the Northern Adirondacks, it's cold, it's clean, it's not polluted, it's not full of germs from other things and other people that are in the area. And in a way that seems touching and amusing to us now, in the Northern Adirondacks, it's entirely a pine and spruce forest. So it smells... We associate those smells with freshness because those are the smells of disinfectants. Pine sol and all those cleaners are often inflected with piney and sprucey smells. So when we're breathing cold air that smells piney, we're apt to think that somehow that's killing germs.
Andrea Barrett, and she is, of course, a prize-winning novelist. Her newest book is titled The Air We Breathe. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the characters in her book, the situations into which they get themselves, and we'll hear her read. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I look forward to hearing from you. And Andrea Barrett is with me. We're talking about her latest novel, The Air We Breathe. In an essay that was published back in 2005, Andrea Barrett wrote, "The more I learned about the First World War, the more I saw how much it had in common with what was known at the time against the war against tuberculosis. Those wars overlap exactly in time, but also, more importantly, in their uses of propaganda and corrupted public language." Explain what you mean.
there's a tone to some of the pamphlets that were written by the Society for the Prevention of Tuberculosis and other organizations that sounds very much like the tone we hear now when we look or listen to examples such as the Four Minute Men who are trying to sell war bonds when we entered World War I, or if you look at posters, recruiting posters for the draft in World War I, a tone of great optimism, of black and white dichotomy, of great simplicity. Don't do this and you will be cured. Do this and you will be cured. Don't speak to Germans and our world will be safe. Enter the war and righteousness will prevail. It's very interesting to compare the posters, for instance, for the draft and the posters that were meant to keep school children aware of what was going on in terms of tuberculosis. There were posters meant to get the children in grade school to go home and yell at their parents for certain health practices in the house. Those were all very well-meaning, a little frightening, too, though.
I should say.
Yeah.
At least some of the characters in this book might be familiar to readers of your National Book Award-winning collection of short stories, Ship Fever, one of them being Leo Marburg. And there's a passage that you might read for us, which talks about Leo.
This is from a little ways into the first chapter, and this is Leo remembering the set of events that actually brought him to the sanatorium that caused him to be pushed away from New York City. Somewhere between Leo's first days on the Lower East Side and his move to Williamsburg and the sugar refinery, between the job in the char house, which he'd hated, and the one he'd made for himself as the head chemist's assistant, his lungs had rotted and all his prospects had disappeared. Working one day at the refinery, he'd walked from the room upstairs where he'd been testing effluent from the melter, down four flights and past the hill that led to the char house, across the floor where the graders were working, and into the corner laboratory next to the dock where the head chemist was analyzing a sample from the ship. He'd given Carl his results, said goodnight, and stepped outside. Near the door was a bin of raw sugar, the last load left to be tested. He'd leaned over to look at the color and rubbed a pinch between his fingers. Then he'd coughed, the same cough he'd had all spring, no more, and watched, astonished, as blood sprayed over the pale crystals. Everything after that had also caught him by surprise, and that itself had been surprising. Despite his 6 years in New York, despite all his jobs and the people he'd met, and the evening classes leading up to his citizenship hearing, he still hadn't expected the way that, once the government was involved, one step led to the next and the next until he was cornered and forced up here. A nurse came to the flat where he'd boarded in Brooklyn. Someone who had seen what happened at the refinery had told someone else, who told someone who worked at the clinic. What a fool he'd been, not to spit over the side of the dock, not to hide his cough. A mouthful of blood on a mountain of sugar, and then this.
He tells one of the nurses that he has no family. He has no one.
No one.
To whom he can turn. So how does he actually end up at the state sanatorium?
As was the case for many people, then once he gets sick, he's in effect funneled through a system of clinics and boards of health. Not so different from the way things work now. Once you have certain diseases, people are required to report those diseases to a board of health, whether it's the city or the state. They in turn are required to report it to someone else. And that's the same journey that Leo mm-hmm. makes. Once the nurse at the clinic sees him, she has to tell someone at the clinic back in Manhattan. Once the doctor at the clinic knows, he has to put his case in front of the review board for the city. Once they know, they start looking for a spot for him in a sanatorium, again, partly to protect him, but largely to protect the health of other people, often rich people from a different part of the city who don't want to be exposed to this disease.
And, of course, we just recently heard about this case of the young man marrying, flying across the ocean when doctors felt that they had told him not to fly. He denied that, but there is a particular drug-resistant strain of tuberculosis around even now.
It's very dangerous now. There, that particular case came out in May, just as I was looking at the proofs of this book, and when I saw the newspaper, I almost couldn't believe it. It was so shocking. And in parallel with that is the case of the man, I believe his name is Robert Daniels. He has dual Russian-American citizenship. He had come to this country to treat a particularly virulent form of tuberculosis, went out without a mask, was jailed in solitary confinement for 11 months, was sent to Denver, had part of his lung removed, was sent back to Arizona, and he was going to be arrested again. He finally fled the country and went back home to Russia. Of course, that interested me because he's Russian, as is Leo Marburg, and he's the same age as Leo. This is 90 years later, but that particular form of extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis is a terrible public health danger, but it's not really different analogously from all forms of tuberculosis in the 20th century. There was no treatment for any form then. There's no treatment for this particular form now. So the ethical questions remain the same. How do we balance the care that is due someone who's sick with the needs of society not to contract this disease?
Tell us about Leo. He does not obviously live in isolation. There are relationships that form, but Leo is quiet. He sort of keeps to himself.
He does. Leo, again, in common with many immigrants then and now, was trained in his former home to do something much different than that which he ends up doing in the States. He was trained as a chemist. He loves chemistry and a lot of forms of science. He ends up working at a relatively menial job when he comes to Brooklyn. So for him, when he goes to the sanatorium, although he doesn't want to be there and he certainly would not choose to be sick, in fact, this is the first chance he's had in 6 years to read, to reflect, to recover his own sense of his authentic self and what he loves intellectually. So he spends a lot of time relearning chemistry, reading old books, thinking about the world. He's more isolated than many of the patients spiritually, not physically.
But there are relationships that form.
There are many relationships. One friend has called it a love quartet as opposed to a love triangle. I like that word. There are two women and also another man from the village named Miles Fairchild, who become entangled with each other. Everybody's got their eye on the wrong person. Everybody's in love with the wrong person, and that has some consequences later.
But nature itself becomes a character in the book.
I hope it does. Nature, the landscape of the Adirondacks, is very important to me, and I tried to bring that alive in the book. As the patients are lying out on those porches, they can't do much, but they can see, and they're out in the weather. And so they're very alert to the trees, the rain, the geese that are flying by, the frogs that are making noises in the trees, the smells and the sounds around them. And if you got that too, I'm glad for that.
Andrea Barrett, and her new novel is titled The Air We Breathe. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. We talked earlier about the fact that some wealthier individuals went to private care homes when they discovered they were infected with tuberculosis. Miles Fairchild is a wealthy cement plant owner. How does his experience differ from that of Leo Marburg?
In some ways, the boarding cottage where he is it's like a fancy hotel, and the surroundings are perhaps not much different from those of his own very nice home in Doylestown. He has a large private room in a small house. He's very well tended to by the housekeeper of that cottage and her daughter. He has access to a car. He has a private doctor that comes and checks on him every few days.
He has kind of a superiority complex.
Yes, he does. He's a smart man and not by nature an evil man, but he does seem to have a sure sense that he knows best for the patients who have less privileges than he does.
And so he is the moving force behind a discussion group.
Yeah, it's a charity project for him. His boarding cottage is down the hill a few miles from the sanatorium. He is himself bored and restless and has a real interest in, as it happens, paleontology and some other things too. And he conceives a project to have a discussion group at the sanatorium for the enlightenment and edification of the inhabitants there. I think when he thinks of it, he imagines himself always leading it and himself always talking.
But that isn't quite the way it turns out.
It's not. The patients rather take over the group for themselves. They come from a tradition, as was very common in the early 20th century in New York and other cities, of self-education groups, of workmen's circles, of people coming together after a long day's work in a factory to have what we would recognize now as a study group or perhaps a reading club, very common now. It was common then, too. People wanted to learn language. They wanted to learn English. They wanted to read books.
Andrea Barrett. Her new book is titled The Air We Breathe. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And we're going to open the phones now. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Robert in Kent, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you, a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Delighted to have you, sir.
Well, thank you. It's a delight to be here and listening to this lady speak about her novel, then. It sounds like it's delightfully written, very great sensitivity and all. My reason for calling was that early in the show she mentioned that there was no treatment for tuberculosis. What she's describing was the treatment at that time, and I think in today's world of usage and drastic overusage of antibiotics, we've forgotten the and yet she mentioned the patient's own immune system, but we tend to forget that it's the immune system in the long run that is able to overcome the disease. The antibiotics, in most instances, some of them kill, some of them inhibit reproduction of their bacteria then, but it's the body's resistance that overcomes the infection in the long run.
I think that's such a good point,
yeah,
Andrea.
That's wonderful, Robert, and your point is very well taken. I didn't mean to imply by saying no treatment that wasn't effective, merely to say that there was no conventional treatment that one could take in the form of a pill or a shot. Of course it was their immune system that was taking care of that. And it's very interesting to hear you raise those issues now, especially this week when everyone's talking about MRSA and infectious diseases that are resistant to drugs in general. It's something we have to think about constantly. I think people like you have been aware of it for a long time. It seems to be coming to broader attention only very recently.
Thanks for calling, Robert. Now to David here in Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good morning, and I must say that I look forward to reading the book.
Good.
And this topic might become more relevant in that in the face of XDR-TB, extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis, and that there's a huge dilemma right now is, what do you do with those folks?
That's a... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, just that, you know, there's a big dilemma in South Africa as we speak, that there's a number of cases, and it can't be treated. It's not, in most cases, it's you can't treat it with drugs.
I've been following those cases with some great interest. It can't be treated. And so the ethical dilemmas are very profound. How are we going to take care of those people? There's no answer for that yet, and I have no idea how this is going to evolve. Part of the reason for writing this book was not to answer those questions. I can't answer them. I'm not a doctor and I'm not a public health person, but to bring those questions into the air to get us to think about those questions as a society, whether it's extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis or some other disease we can't even predict yet, we're always going to have to wrestle with those questions and think about them. It's terrifying, I know.
The other factor, of course, is that so many people out there are resisting vaccination, and the preventive for many of the most common diseases, like measles.
Yeah, this is something that's really interesting, too. The sentiment against vaccination continues to grow, and yet I think most public health people still feel very strongly that it is one of the most effective, if not the most effective, preventatives for many diseases. So it's quite frightening also to think about a generation of children not being vaccinated.
We'll take just a short break here. And if you'd like to join us with your questions, comments, call us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From UVA's Miller Center, presenting a national debate November 13th on balancing Americans' right to privacy with national security interests. Live webcast and PBS broadcast information at millercenter.org. And from the NASDAQ Educational Foundation, dedicated to innovation and entrepreneurship around the world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate the 40th anniversary of The Graduate. We'll hear from the film's star, Dustin Hoffman, its co-writer, Buck Henry, and director, Mike Nichols. There's a new 40th anniversary DVD edition. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Andrea Barrett won the National Book Award for her book of short stories titled Ship Fever. Now her latest novel, all about people who are in a sanatorium in the Adirondacks because they have tuberculosis, is titled The Air We Breathe. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. One of the other characters in the book, Naomi, Martin and her mother have a very, very cold and distant relationship. Naomi's mother accidentally scolds Naomi's baby brother. I wondered where that story came from and whether it was something that you had seen in your own life, where it came from.
It's actually a story that my mother told me, and I believe it is about her grandmother and then her mother. She told me this only when I was well into the writing of the book, and I was well into my 40s by then, and she had never mentioned this. And one day when I was living in Philadelphia and talking about some of this material, she said, oh, I want to tell you a story about my grandmother. And in essence, the bones of the story are the same. Her mother had a little brother. There was an incident with some bath water that was too hot, not as described in the novel, but the water was hot in the same way. And she accidentally dipped the little boy, the baby, without testing the water first into the tub of water, and he died. Yeah, it's a terrible story.
Now, what fascinates me about this, Andrea, is that you wrote about it having never heard your mother talk about it, which takes me once more to Maggie Sharp's stories about our cellular memories, mm-hmm. that somehow we know, even if we don't know.
How do we know these things? That's so curious to me. I've almost never met a writer who hasn't experienced some example of this. We write things that we believe we are wholly inventing. We set up characters and situations that seem to us to have been pulled from the air, and then 6 months or 6 years later, the situation will seem to crystallize out in the real world before our eyes. How does that possibly happen?
Your mother must have been stunned that you were writing this.
Well, she was surprised for two reasons. The other is that when I was deep into the tuberculosis research for the book, I was actually working on the earlier story, The Cure. Again, I'm close to my mother, and I was very close to her mother, who died when I was 12. I thought I knew a fair bit about them. But after several years of working with tuberculosis material, she said, oh, you know, I never told you this, but your mother was in a sanatorium. Her mother was in a sanatorium. And I said, no, you never told me that. And it turned out that her mother had been for a year in a sanatorium in White Plains, New York. My mother was then 8, and her brother was a few years younger. So children weren't allowed to visit the sanatorium. So for a year, the way she saw her mother was her father would drive her and her brother to the parking lot of the sanatorium. Her mother would come out on the porch of the room, and my mother's father would hold her and her brother up on the hood of the car so that they could wave to each other. The two children would wave to the mother. The mother would wave down at them. And my mother and her mother had a somewhat distant relationship, which as a girl I never understood, but I certainly understood that very differently after hearing that story. You know, imagine being parted from your mother at that crucial age and your girlfriend. And then when she was sent back home, they couldn't touch each other for several years after that. Her mother came back to the house, but because of the risk of contagion, the children weren't allowed to hug her, kiss her, do more than wave from the entrance of the room.
Andrea, it couldn't be an accident that you wrote this novel.
It felt like an accident, but I have to agree with you. It can't have been an accident.
It cannot have been an accident. Let's go to Chaplin, Connecticut. Good morning, Bob. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, Diane. Best show on public radio.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
I plan to read your novel. I really look forward to it. I was wondering, the book sounds similar, both in terms of the time period and the physical location, that is, in a sanatorium, to Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain. I was wondering if you were influenced at all thematically by Mann's novel, and what other influences, as far as authorship, you have.
I was more than influenced by the Magic Mountain. I was writing this really in direct response to that. I know that novel well and love it very much. And over the years, I started to think about inverting that novel. The Magic Mountain is about wealthy patients in a very exclusive resort in Europe on the eve of the start of World War I for them. And I thought, how could the American experience be reflected in that same pattern? So rather than rich patients, these are poor immigrants. Rather than a deluxe resort in Switzerland, this is a somewhat prison-like building in an American mountain setting. Everything in that novel is sort of turned over and re-examined from the backside in this novel, but I certainly would not have written this novel without that.
Does that make sense to you, Bob?
Yeah, I was wondering if it was in response. That's exactly what I hoped
yeah.
for.
Yeah, it is.
I think that Magic Mountain is a great novel, and it calls for a response, and that's great.
Thanks.
Thanks for calling. I think people are going to be surprised to hear that you dropped out of high school.
Well, it's still a surprise to me. I didn't quite drop out, but I did go to college without finishing high school. I went to college in the 70s when it was actually still possible to do things like this. I was very unhappy in high school.
Why?
A complicated question. I went to a small high school in a rural area. The classes, I'll simply say, did not seem to nourish what I needed at that point in my life. So I skipped school constantly. I was always out under a bridge reading Thomas Mann, for instance. And because it was the 70s and things were a little more flexible, I just decided to apply to college during my junior year in high school. And quite amazingly, a couple schools took me. So I just went, and I still don't have a high school diploma.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Union College in Schenectady mm-hmm. in upstate New York.
And where did you meet your husband?
I met him in college. We met when we were preposterously young. We were 16 and 19 when we met. We were not together continuously, but we did end up getting married when we were in our mid-20s.
Huh. Just a wonderful story. Let's go now to Anne Arundel County. Good morning, Larry. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Well, it's always an honor to be able to talk with you and your guests.
Thank you.
Regarding the infectiousness of tuberculosis, in the 80s, prisons and probably other institutions were going to a major effort to stop this possible spread, because there was a great fear that there was a drug-resistant strain was developing. And among other, now I was in Texas where I was, but also in Maryland, probably in the late 80s, early 90s, there was, in fact, a potential development of a drug-resistant strain in one of the prisons, in a prison in Western Maryland. The physician there had not followed protocol and had not given the full cocktail of drugs as a prophylaxis to inmates who were potentially tuberculous.
Interesting.
And it caused quite an uproar. He lost his job over that.
Yeah, very interesting.
That is.
Prison populations had to be terribly at risk, I would think.
Very much so, and they still are. Prisons are a kind of classic breeding ground for all sorts of terrible diseases. Typhus, which I've written about before, was sometimes called prison fever. It was more common there than any place else.
Andrea Barrett, her new novel is titled The Air We Breathe. At 10 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now to West Palm Beach, Florida. Good morning, Betty Sue. You're on the air. Let's see. Are you there, Betty Sue? I guess not. Now to, let's try Melissa, who's in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I was curious, because of kind of the recent discussion of the proposed sort of avian flu pandemic and kind of as a parallel to the tuberculosis back then. And I haven't read the book, although on the way home from work I will be picking it up. I wondered what the impact was, or if the book talked about the impact on the families when they were segregated, and on, say, the breadwinners when they had to go away, and what the impact is on the families.
Had to have been pretty substantial, Andrea.
Oh, it was substantial, verging on the catastrophic. There was not Social Security then. Most people didn't have health insurance or disability insurance. Those things didn't really exist. So if the breadwinner in a family got tuberculosis and was sent away, his wife, children, perhaps dependent parents suddenly had no income coming in, no one to rely on. It was a terrible thing.
Was there any government support for the family at all if the breadwinner were taken away?
In some municipalities, there were. Federal aid didn't work then the way it works now, so charity or assistance tended to be distributed by towns, cities, sometimes by the counties. So it was up to that municipality to decide if that family in need was going to be given direct assistance or not. Sometimes they were and sometimes they weren't. Sometimes their neighbors would help them. Sometimes a church or a synagogue would help them. Sometimes no one would help them.
Let's go now to Indianapolis. Good morning, Dan. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I wanted to comment on talking about the cellular memory, basically, of how you write, Andrea. I wanted to find out, is this the first time that's happened? I'm a musician, and I found that sometimes in the stories that I write within my songs, it ends up happening kind of the same sort of thing. I've had people come up and tell me in my family that specific things that I've written about have actually been stories that I had never heard of. I was wondering if this is the first time that that's happened to you, or has it happened before?
It has happened to me before in lesser forms, but very often. It's a continual amazement to me. Artists in all fields, there's some way that our intuition operates that seems to allow us to tap into stories that we are not aware that we know. We do know them at some level. How we know them is beyond me, but at some level we do know them. I don't know whether it comes into us through the culture, it comes into us through our families. I'm not sure, but it's a fascinating phenomenon.
It certainly is. To Yuma, Arizona. Good morning, Nona Ruth.
Hello. I wanted to tell you that in about 1948, my husband was diagnosed with tuberculosis. We lived in Chicago, and he was sent to the tuberculosis sanitarium because we had a four-year-old at home, and I was pregnant. Mm-hmm. And at that time, they started giving streptomycin.
Right. He must have been one of the early patients to receive that.
Right. And when my baby was born, she was taken directly from the hospital to a foster home, and she was vaccinated with BCG. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I am, but I've not heard of a baby being taken and vaccinated
right,
like
was,
that.
Yeah, she's taken directly from the hospital.
I don't understand why. Why was she taken from you?
Because she had not been exposed to tuberculosis in any way, shape, or form at the hospital.
Huh.
So she was taken from the hospital to a foster home where she remained for 6 weeks.
Oh, my.
After being vaccinated with BCG.
Yeah.
And then for years afterwards, she used to have to go down and get tested. And she's always tested positive for tuberculosis, but she doesn't have it. She's vaccinated.
When did your husband come back from the sanatorium? How old was your daughter then?
Well, they finally decided that he had arrested tuberculosis, and they sent him home.
Oh.
So how many years was he in the sanatorium?
Probably a year, maybe a little less.
Wow.
That's a terrible story, but not an uncommon one. People meant to protect.
Do they still vaccinate with BCG?
I don't believe that they do, but I'm honestly not sure. Not as conversant with current tuberculosis treatment as I should be.
Nona Ruth, how did you support yourself while your husband
that was a real problem.
Yeah.
We lived in a three-room apartment, and I took in a couple of ladies as roomers.
Oh, That was actually a very common strategy for women in your situation when their husbands or parents were taken away. Especially if you had children at home, you couldn't go out to work. So bringing in boarders or roomers was one way, a difficult way, but a possible way to make ends meet. That must have been a terrible time for you.
It was a terrible time, but it cemented a marriage, and my kids all grew up, and, you know.
Oh, that's wonderful.
The one good thing about it, he was rejected from the draft, and he didn't have to go to war.
That was a good thing.
That's very interesting. Nona Ruth, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. And Andrea Barrett, clearly your novel has touched a lot of people in lots of different places. It's a lovely book. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And thanks for writing. And everybody, thanks for listening this morning. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.